It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, Master of Wine Mary Ewing Mulligan puts wine where she thinks it belongs. It's all about taste. She says quality is second to flavor, and geography is more important than the grape. Well, Mary's book is Wine Style. The Sterns have found the classic Montreal bagel. Who knew? Sweet little pocket melons, super lush tomatoes, and a day glow lettuce. It's new ideas for gardeners from gardening expert Jack Staub. Then it's the Ugly Ripes versus the Florida Tomato Committee's Little Miss Americas. And we've got a round of Stump the Cook with guest stump master Christopher Kimball. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Peel me a grape, crush me some ice, skin me a peach, save the fuzz for my pillow. Talk to me nice, talk to me nice, you've got to wine me and dine me. Don't try to fool me, be jewelly, either amuse me or lose me. I'm getting hungry. Peel me a grape. Pop me a cork, French me a fry, crack me a nut, bring a bowl full of bonbons. Chill me some wine, keep standing by, just entertain me. Champagne me, show me you love me. Kid, love me, best way to cheer me. Cashmere me, I'm getting hungry. Here's how to be an agreeable chap. Love me and leave me in luxury's lap. Hop when I holler, skip when I snap. When I say do it, jump to it. Sent out for scotch, boil me a crab. Cut me a rose, make my tea with the petals. Just hang around, pick up the tab, and never outthink me. Just mink me, polar bear rug me. Don't bug me, new thunder burn me. You heard me, I'm getting hungry. Peel me a grape. Here's how to be an agreeable chap. Love me and leave me in luxury's lap. Hop when I holler, skip when I snap. When I say do it, scotch, boil me a crab, cut me a rose, make my tea with the petals. Just hang around, pick up the tab, never outthink me. Just mink me, polar bear rug me. Don't
It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. You know, I like Mary Ewing Mulligan's style. She's a master of wine who does not do hype. Now, in Wine Style, her latest book, she has some controversial opinions. Well, personally, I think they're great assists for any of us who have ever been handed a wine list in a restaurant or shopped for a bottle to go with dinner. Vegetable gardening expert Jack Staub plays to the gardener's love of the little-known gem. Three new vegetables you are going to have to try this year. Then we play Stump the Cook with guest stump master Christopher Kimball, and it's the dinner plate you can toss when you're done. We're going back to MIT's Counterintelligence Lab. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. Jane, Michael, you've been up in Montreal examining the Jewish food scene up there. And it's not a place we think of as being a center for Jewish food. But what did you find?
We found some incredible Jewish food, slightly different than what one expects in a USA Jewish deli, but really wonderful. One of the most interesting things that you find in Montreal, and Montreal only, is a particular kind of bagel made at a couple bagel places in the city, and it looks pretty much like a regular bagel, mm-hmm. slightly smaller. And honestly, at first bite, I said, "Oh, this isn't very good. It's a little too sweet. I don't know. The texture isn't as muscular as a New York bagel." But after a couple days of eating these, we were hooked.
They're baked in wood-fired ovens that are on 24 hours a day, so they have this wood smoke, slightly sweet flavor, and I'm telling you, I am addicted to these things. Why they have not been sent beyond Montreal is one of the great culinary mysteries.
So are they flavored with sugar or honey?
No. Well, they must have a little pinch of sugar in them, but they're not really sweet.
They're not sweet. That's just a hint of sweetness to the dough. I mean, the best variation, in my opinion, is made at a place called Fairmount Bagel, where they make a bagel, an onion bagel, and the outside of it is spangled with those slightly charred bits of onion mm-hmm, that add mm-hmm. that sort of sweet, oniony flavor to it that is really wonderful. Now, the interesting thing about the bagel places in Montreal is that there's no place to sit and eat, but what you can do is buy, say, 4 to 6 bagels for the pair of us, and they'll sell you a pint of cream cheese, and you get a plastic knife, and you go outside and stand on the street and eat them.
But listen, enough with the bagels. Michael and I found our holy grail of babka.
Oh.
I mean, we had no idea that Montreal was this wildly exotic city and, you know, this incredible ethnic population. But at a place called Chesky's Hamisha Bakery.
Why don't you translate what Hamisha means for folks?
Kind of
folksy.
Folksy, nice,
homey,
kindly.
One of us.
It's a wonderful name for a bakery.
But anyway, this babka,
let me
babka.
Just say that
okay.
Most babkas stink. I mean, they're either too bready or too cakey.
Now, this is a coffee cake, for those who don't know what babka
It's a coffee cake with swirls of either chocolate or poppy seed in the dough. And in my opinion, they're either way too much like bread and aren't kind of cakey enough, or they're just like kind of sweet, cakey, and cloying. This is the perfect, it just teeters on the edge of bread and cake.
It's almost like, I'll try and give you a visual. If you took great dough and you stretched it from Montreal to maybe Nebraska and it was incredibly thin, and then you spread good chocolate on it, and then you wrapped it up, wound it up until it's a loaf that's maybe 15 inches long by 10 inches wide, baked it, ooh. And then you cut it, and it is just like, I don't want to use a French word because I'm going to screw it up. Millefeuille.
Yeah. It's like puff pastry.
Yeah, but a babka.
It's delicate but deeply satisfying. And the great thing is that Montreal also happens to have some of the best coffee and coffee shops, so you can buy one of these loaves and take it to a coffee shop and nosh on the loaf while you drink good coffee.
But wait, there's more. We have to. We can't end without telling you about smoked meat, which is like an entire genre of Jewish Montreal food. It's kind of the Montreal version of a corned beef or a brisket sandwich.
Well, it's made from brisket, and it's generally similar to pastrami in that it's more spiced
right.
and smoked. And it's always hand-sliced because the way they do it in Montreal is it would be far too delicate to ever put in an automatic slicer. They pile it high on really good rye bread. And the great thing is when you order either lean, which nobody wants, medium, which is kind of medium fatty, or fatty, which is like 90% fat.
And it's served hot, right? It's hot.
And, oh, of course, hot. This is hot corned beef with of course, a smear of mustard.
Your wrist.
Now, the thing is, medium sounded not interesting enough. Fatty sounded too fatty. So the waiter in Schwartz's suggested that we order it extra medium. And that was perfect because that was sort of like between medium and fatty.
So if I can't get you a New York deli, I'm going to head to Montreal, right?
Oh, yeah. It's the real thing.
Hey, guys, thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn. Bye.
Lynn.
Gene and Michael Stern are the authors of Road Food. Now, you can tune into the Sterns right here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, take a look at our upcoming trip. Now, we're heading to Santa Fe. It's a combination of two of what I think of as the finer things in life, food and music. In August, we are headed to the high desert of Santa Fe. Now, the trip includes tickets to the Santa Fe Opera and the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival and a dinner and market tour with me. So check out the website for more details. I think it's going to be a dynamite trip. SplendidTable.org, guys. Gardeners love the obscure, the secret gem nobody else is growing. I mean, this is why niche seed catalogs do so well. Anybody can find a Better Boy tomato, but to unearth the super sweet little melon that Queen Anne carried in her pocket 300 years ago, that is jackpot material. Well, this is exactly what vegetable gardening expert and writer Jack Staub did in his book, 75 Exciting Vegetables for Your Garden. And he handles each vegetable like a fascinating person. Hey, Jack, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, this book feels so good in the hand. It's a beautiful little book.
Thank you.
Now, you lecture, from what I understand, on gardening history as well as modern growing techniques. So if you could put both of those together, what kind of garden would you like to see us try this year?
I would say that anyone who has not tried the concept of raised beds and multiple beds in their garden versus one big vegetable plot with a bunch of linear disposed vegetables, that is the first thing to try. If you raise your beds, literally build a box, no more than 4 feet broad so you don't have to step into the bed to garden.
Right.
You don't compact your soil, you don't crush your seedlings. The raised bed drains more easily. It heats up faster in the winter. And, of course, you can amend it much more easily because it's like filling a box.
Now, I'm trying to picture this. I've got a box. How high is that box?
That box can be anywhere from 8 inches. You can use 2x8s and just create a box out of 4 pieces of 2x8s.
Right.
Or they can be raised. For instance, if you're wheelchair-bound, there's a wonderful garden at the New York Botanical Garden that is built 4 feet high so that you can garden from your wheelchair.
Now, I'm just thinking about people with back problems and, you know, knee problems and all of that kind of thing. This would be a godsend.
Exactly. And also having multiple beds allows you to dispose your vegetables in a much more attractive way. So if you think of it as an exercise in French parterre gardening.
What does that mean, French parterre gardening?
Parterre literally means on the ground or by the earth. And those gardens were always meant to be seen from on high, so they looked like carpets almost.
Ooh.
You know, they're very intensively designed with paths in between. And if you go to any of the great Renaissance chateaux in France or Italy, you will see parterre gardens of the kind I'm speaking about. Probably the most famous one in the world is Villandry.
Oh, I've seen that garden. It's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. And it's all vegetables, too. It's absolutely unbelievable.
It's a fabulous place. Jack, you have 75 vegetables in this book, but could you pick a handful for us to try maybe this year?
I would be happy to. I really am in love with vegetables, and as I have become a gardener, I have really tried to search out the prettiest vegetables, not only for the palate, but for the eye. I'll start with one called Australian yellowleaf lettuce. Lettuces, of course, are an early crop. They're usually 40 to 50 days, so they're a very immediate gratification in the garden in the spring.
Oh, yeah.
And Australian yellowleaf is unique because out of the many beautiful lettuces that exist, and there are countless of them, in bronze and stripes and dapplings and greens and blues, this is the only one that's actually a kind of brilliant, almost neon chartreuse yellow in color. And it has a very lovely, open, loose-leaf habit with ruffled edges. It's got a delicious non-fibrous, quite sweet taste, and also is kind of winningly slow-bolting in the summer, which is a great thing for gardeners.
Which means that it's going to hold up a bit when it starts to get rather hot.
Exactly, because lettuces are really spring and fall crops.
Yeah. I can just see this mixed with flowers in that color.
Exactly, and that's another thing, is that people should think about cottage gardening, and even when you have a decorative border, there's no reason not to pop in a few very attractive vegetables.
What next?
Of course, everybody plants tomatoes. 95% of home gardeners plant tomatoes. It's their favorite food crop.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, there's one called purple calabash. It's an old heirloom, and it is the deepest purple tomato you can grow. It's a lovely, deeply fluted, kind of old-fashioned-looking tomato, and it is famous for its very rich and complex taste. It's probably the most complex, some people call winey, in its taste. But also the deepest purple, and I always grow 4 or 6 varieties of tomatoes and try to grow a becoming range of sizes and colors, and It's always an interesting one to grow because of its deep purple coloration.
Oh, it sounds beautiful. Another choice.
The final vegetable I'd like to talk about, actually a berry, as it's a melon, is the Queen Anne's Pocket that you mentioned in your introduction, which is a lovely little melon, probably Persian by birth 3,000 years ago. And as you mentioned, it was carried by Queen Anne of England, who was Queen of England at the turn of the 18th century, in her pocket in an era not known for its personal hygiene exactly. It is an incredibly intensely sweet-scented melon, and she carried it in her pocket as a form of personal deodorant, really. That said, you don't need to do that. It's a lovely melon to grow because of its small size, so it matures slightly faster. Melons are a long-season plant. They need a long, hot season and kind of constant watering in the middle of the season.
Uh-huh.
But this one is only about 3 inches, about the size of a tennis ball, beautifully striped with jagged orange and yellow stripes, and also has a very light honeydew-like flavor, so it's a lovely one to grow.
Oh, this sounds lovely. I was reading, and you said that in the 18th century there was a gardener who believed the way you made melons sweet was by watering them with honey water?
Yes, there was a gardener who believed that, but there was also a gardener who believed that you could turn a white beet red by watering it with red wine, so they were not always accurate in their assumptions.
Jack, thank you so much.
It has been my pleasure entirely.
Jack Staub is author of 75 Exciting Vegetables for Your Garden. Now, Jack left us with mail order sources for his 3 vegetable picks. Find them on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Now, each week you get a quick recipe, some shopping tips, and some technique tips. But best of all, Weeknight Kitchen's free. So sign up, you know where, splendidtable.org. Coming up, a master of wine talks about what's really important in that bottle, ugly tomatoes, and stump the cook. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media.
Thank you.
Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our show is brought to you by SuperTarget, home of Archer Farms, where you can find modern takes on old-time classics like angel food cake, quiche, and garlic bread. Find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Master of Wine Mary Ewing Mulligan and her husband Ed McCarthy claim that their latest book is a retaliation. Now, these two have expertise from decades of researching wines around the world. Now, they meld that with the ability to put themselves in the shoes of the novice wine drinker, meaning most of us. Now, this is what they do in this latest tome. The book is called Wine Style, Using Your Senses to Explore and Enjoy Wine. Mary, good to have you back.
Thank you, Lynn. It's great to be here.
You know, Mary, you call this book a retaliation. What are you battling here?
Well, you know, I think that one of the issues that was close to my heart in writing this book is maintaining diversity of wine tastes. And it comes from the fact that, despite the fact that there are so many labels today, you walk into a wine shop or a supermarket and you see more labels than you've ever seen before. And yet, most of those wines taste the same. And gradually, certain styles of wine or taste profiles of wine are disappearing. And I don't want to see that happen because I like to drink them, maybe not every day, but sometimes. And I like diversity in wine.
But is this really, we prefer that smaller selection? In so many words, is this the act of the market demands?
Well, it is, of course. Marketing is a key issue in wine. We like to think that wine is somehow, you know, above it all, somehow rises above the dirty business of of other products. But marketing is very much an issue. And marketers, what do they do? They look at what's selling, and they make more of what's selling so that more people will buy that which is selling. And, of course, this can lead to a certain uniformity of taste. It is partially due to the fact that these styles are popular, but there's no reason that the other styles shouldn't hang there in the background and give people a chance to try them now and then. And eventually, again, possibly some of the styles that used to be popular will be popular again.
Is this the reason why every time I turn around I see Chardonnay?
Well, you know, one of the things that we wine lovers have always loved about wine is that every bottle of wine is different. We like to say every bottle of wine is a live performance, not quite like any other one. And yet, so many of these Chardonnays taste exactly the same. They have different labels. They might come from different places, but they taste exactly the same.
Yeah. And one of the things I always want to know from experts, people like you, is the real nitty-gritty. I equate buying a bottle of wine for most of us with going to the computer store. When I go in to buy software, I do not want to have had researched all the journals and whatever. And quite frankly, I can't trust necessarily the $7 an hour kid behind the counter. No offense. So I'm on my own. All right, the same is true in a wine store. Is what can help me on that label?
I think that there are two key factors that you can find on the label. First of all, the label won't always tell you a lot, unfortunately. And so I think you have to look at some of the fine print on the label. And I think that there are two issues. One is where the wine is from. Of course, we know wine from different places tastes different. But in a broader sense, if you're looking for a very flavorful wine, you know, the way a Big Mac is flavorful, you put it in your mouth and wham,
it explodes.
Here I am, lots of taste, you know. Compare that with putting a very subtle sole meunier in your mouth or something like that.
Right. Sauteed sole with a little butter and salt.
Yeah, exactly. And so if you want that flavor intensity, either because you like it or because the foods that you're having are very flavorful and you want a lot of flavor intensity, generally speaking, you're safe if you go to a wine that's from California or from Australia. If you want more subtlety in your wine, and not just because you're having subtle food, sometimes you just want the wine to take a background role in the meal. You don't want to have to stop and be paying attention to the wine. You just want it to sit there and accommodate the food.
Right.
Then you should look for a European wine, broadly speaking, because European wines have less flavor intensity. I think that in America we pay too much attention to what the flavors in wine are. Does this wine taste like gooseberry, or does this wine taste like citrus or fresh mown grass or what? And we don't think about the flavor quotient. And I think that that's more meaningful, actually, in terms of whether you like a wine or not, and also how it combines with food.
Yeah.
I think another issue when you're judging wine, you know, you're trying to buy a wine by yourself, for example, in a supermarket, and you have to look at the labels and try not to be, you know, wowed by the cute name or the colorful label, is to look at the alcohol level. Wines that are 13% alcohol and higher generally are going to be fuller bodied, more robust wines. They're going to have a lot more presence on the table than a wine that is, let's say, 11 to 13%. 11 to 13% is going to be a more discreet wine, a more gentle wine in terms of its overall profile, its overall style. And below 11%, generally speaking, especially below 10%, you're going to get a slightly sweet wine. And this is information that is on every label. And so it's something that you can look at as sort of a clue to the weight of the wine.
Interesting. And I'm just thinking that a lot of people hear slightly sweet wine and they you know, their noses go up in the air because we are not supposed to like slightly sweet wine. But I'm thinking about the way we eat these days, spice and big, bold flavor. And sometimes that slightly sweet wine or that very bold wine is what you need to go with that food.
You're exactly right. And in fact, lots of, especially at the inexpensive price points, I'm picking on Chardonnay today, sorry. But lots of California Chardonnays, for example, at inexpensive price points are actually a little bit sweet as well as being very flavorful. Now, we call them dry wines. You know, no one thinks that he or she is drinking a slightly sweet wine.
Right.
But in fact, they work well with those kinds of foods, foods that have fruit in them, for example, or fruity sauces, you know, or very spicy foods because of that little bit of sweetness. But also another great example is German Riesling, much of which has a little bit of residual sweetness to it, and yet the acidity is so high it doesn't really taste sweet. And those are wonderful, well-balanced wines that can be a joy with food.
Interesting, though. You know, the wines that have shaped so much of what our tastes are in the past have come from one third of the world that doesn't generally eat the spice and the sweet and the hot and the whatever, and what is infiltrating our palates now and our plates are from the other parts of the world. It's intriguing.
Yes, you're absolutely right. But just as I would hate to see the non-spicy, non-Pacific Rim foods disappear from the face of the earth, I would hate to see those more sedate wines disappear.
Yeah.
And that's part of what I believe in, is maintaining diversity, both in food tastes and in wine tastes.
Yeah. Mary, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Mary Ewing Mulligan and Ed McCarthy are authors of Wine Sense, using your senses to explore and enjoy wine. A philosophical moment. Just like it isn't easy being green, or shall we say, less than lovely, in marketing produce, looking gorgeous is rule one. Tasting good, well, that's somewhere down there around number five. I mean, it's the same thing as Britney Spears' elusive musical abilities. Nobody cares. Look good and the planet is yours. Unless you're a tomato and you have Florida writer Julie Houserman in your corner.
Psst, buddy. Hey, buddy. You want something good? I got a good tomato here. Yeah. Not the kind that tastes like cardboard. This one has some taste. Sure, it don't look too pretty, but man, one taste and you're in heaven. No. Don't ask how I got it. That's my business. Let's just say it wasn't easy, all right? Don't laugh. It may have come to this. All you northerners jonesing for a decent tomato in the winter have a corporate cabal to blame down here in the Sunshine State. We used to ship you some good tomatoes. They were called Ugly Ripes, an heirloom with wrinkles and deep grooves and a juicy summertime flavor. True tomato connoisseurs adore the uglies. But that was before the Florida Tomato Committee made a decision that doomed any chance of a decent BLT in the winter. The committee decided in 2004 that most of the Ugly Ripes were too ugly to be exported from Florida. Officially, they said most of the uglies didn't meet the state's standards for roundness. Florida's sent you lots of round tomatoes over the years. They may be round, they may look like a tomato, but we all know they don't taste like one. The Ugly Ripes are different. They're grown by a company called Procacci Brothers out of Philadelphia. They worked hard to develop this tasty tomato. It started as a French heirloom. Unlike most Florida tomatoes, these are picked by hand and packed in spongy sleeves so they don't bruise. If you're lucky enough to find an Ugly Ripe this winter, it probably came from Mexico. Most of the Ugly Ripes grown in Florida now have to stay in Florida, all because the Florida Tomato Committee is obsessed with style over substance. The people who sit on the Tomato Committee grow the round tomatoes that Florida's been exporting for years. The tomato fight isn't a small matter. It's even made its way all the way to Washington. Two Pennsylvania senators filed a bill last spring that would basically overrule the Florida Tomato Committee. And they're trying to get the Ugly Ripes put in a special category so the Tomato Committee won't be able to set rules on them. One of the Tomato Committee members had the gall to compare the tomato fight to the Miss America pageant. "How often have you seen an ugly woman in the pageant?" he said. "The same thing applies here." Hear this, Tomato Committee. I'm sick of round tomatoes that are picked green and gassed to turn pink. I'm crushed when I cut into a tomato that looks good and find out it's mushy and hard inside. I don't want veggies on Botox. I'm pulling for the Ugly Ripes. As Grandma always told us kids, it's what's on the inside that counts.
Yeah. There ain't nothing in the world that I like better than bacon and lettuce and homegrown tomatoes. Up in the morning, out in the garden, get you a ripe one. Don't get a hard one, plant them in the spring. Eat them in the summer, all winter without them, the culinary bummer. I forget all about that, sweating and digging every time I go out and pick me a big one. Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes, what'd life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes.
Writer Julie Hauserman has been known to eat her fresh tomato sandwiches while leaning over the kitchen sink in Tallahassee, Florida. Well, I have got a tomato recipe for you, and believe it or not, it isn't bad with even out-of-season tomatoes. It's called Big Tomato Sweet Sour Salad, and all is revealed on the website, splendidtable.org. It's time to play Stump the Cook, the Splendid Table refrigerator game. Now, here's how it works. A listener calls in with five things in their refrigerator, nothing with green fuzz on it or anything shriveled up. Now, I have to come up with a dish with those five ingredients that the caller would really eat. Now, our judge is our guest stump master, Christopher Kimball, editor and publisher of Cook's Illustrated Magazine and host of PBS's America's Test Kitchen. Chris, good to have you back.
Well, I love judging you. This is going to be fun.
I'm ready to play. Why don't you explain how the rules work?
Well, in addition to the five ingredients that our guest will offer you, you may also use salt and pepper. You
mm-hmm.
may call
right.
for three more ingredients, which she has to have somewhere in her kitchen. And I just want to make sure, Lynn, you don't know the guest participant here, right?
No. I am completely in the dark.
Okay, let's get started with Christine, who is going to tell us about her five ingredients.
Okay, I'm interested in fresh mozzarella cheese.
Fresh mozz, right, okay.
With some kind of beef, I'm thinking about a round steak.
Now, you really have this in your fridge?
I really do.
Okay, round steak. All right, go ahead.
Parsley. And how about whipped cream, fresh whipped cream?
Fresh whipped cream. All right. That's what you lick up as you're cooking, but go ahead.
And then let's go with a can of corn.
Can of corn. Oh boy.
A good
a can
Midwest
of corn.
Dish.
Everything was going great till the can of corn.
Okay, this right. is, I can, water's free, salt and pepper is free, and then I get three ingredients, but you have to really have them. Have you got any horseradish?
Yes, I do.
You do? Okay, you know what we're going to do? We are going to treat this round steak like a London broil. You know, we're going to cook it slow, keep it really rare. This is what I want to do. I want you to mix the whipped cream
with horseradish to taste. We're going to make essentially a horseradish sauce. All right?
I'm just waiting for the corn here.
Now, patience, okay? And I want you to fold in a little bit of parsley, okay? And have you got lemon?
I sure do.
Fresh lemon. A few squeezes of lemon juice to taste,
okay?
And then sear that steak on a grill. Salt and pepper it, obviously. Just really fast sear, and then move it aside so that you're going to cook it really slow. You want to keep it rare, medium rare to rare. So that means when you stick an instant reading thermometer in it, it's going to read about 125 degrees. You're going to let it rest for about 5 minutes or so. As it's resting, put a little olive oil. That should be ingredient number 3 for me, Chris, I think.
Well, that's always your first ingredient, Lynn. You know that.
Yeah, I know. If
even goes on your desserts.
Yes, exactly. I want you to heat a little olive oil in a pan, and I'd like you to very gently melt a bit of that mozzarella. I want you to put the mozzarella in slices, and it's just going to sear a little bit on the outside, and it'll get really runny on the inside. And you're going to put that on a plate, and you're going to pile that corn on top of it with a little salt and pepper. No, really, because you're going to get this kind of crispy, creamy, and then the crunch of the corn. And then you'll thin slice on an angle, okay, that steak, and you will have that wonderful horseradish blend sitting on the plate next to it. You dip the steak into the cream and horseradish, and then you take a little bite of that cheese and corn.
You got all the ingredients in. Yeah, I can't believe you did it.
You see, you have too many doubts, Chris. You are not a believer. Okay, guys, what do you think?
That sounded beautiful.
This sounds like architectural food at home. It's great. You get a London boil. Makes sense. I'm with you with a steak. I'm with you with the corn. The sautéed mozzarella was a bit strange. But, Christine, overall, how did you like it?
I think it's going to be good.
Well, it'll certainly be the first time you've sautéed mozzarella and corn on top.
Yes, it will be.
So it'll definitely be a first.
I win, and Christine, the check will be in the mail.
And Christine, thanks so much for playing.
It was a riot. Honestly, that sounded great.
And now I know what to do with mozzarella and corn. I'm all set.
Oh, you are such a doubter, Chris Kimball. But hey, thanks for judging.
Any day I get to judge you is a good day, Lynn.
Our guest celebrity stump master is Christopher Kimball, editor and publisher of Cook's Illustrated magazine and host of PBS's America's Test Kitchen. Now, if you want to challenge me in Stump the Cook, give us a call, 800-537-5252. One of our canny producers may call you to be on the air. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, if you don't live in Minnesota, you probably don't know the great significance of this past week. The end of February and early March is a very important time. It's time to drag, or in some cases, float, our ice houses off of our 10,000 lakes, which, believe it or not, brings me to our trivia question. Now, the question is, which American lake was a culinary and social status symbol in London in the 1840s? A little esoterica. Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle. Online at Target.com/SuperTarget. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, which American lake was a culinary and social status symbol in London in the 1840s? Well, it was Lake Wenham near Boston. This was one of America's major ice exporters. One of America's major ice exporters made ice cut from Lake Wenham all the rage in London. In fact, the writer William Makepeace Thackeray wrote about how the social season dinners were sort of the same old, the same fashions, the same people, the same food, and the same lumps of Wenham Lake ice. Now, shipping ice from lakes and ponds had been going on for an awfully long time, as in 2,000 years. Now, the trick to Wenham Lake's success was image building. The London office of the American company kept a big chunk of the clear ice on their windowsill. I mean, people could come up and they could touch it. They could see that it was real. And since they replaced it constantly, it seemed it never melted. Now, you have to remember that this was the time when America's second largest crop by weight to be transported by train or ship was ice. Cotton, by the way, was the first one. Now, I found all of this in Mariana Gosnell's book, Ice. It's a good read, and the research seems sound. Take a look at it. It's time for your call, so pick up that phone. The number's 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the lines. We have got Jay on the line from Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Jay, what do you want to talk about?
I have a question about the difference between ricotta, cottage cheese, quark, and something that I had on a trip to France that was served as a dessert that was suspiciously like cottage cheese.
It may have been fromage frais.
Okay.
What was it called? Do you
now,
remember?
I don't remember
okay.
what that
okay.
was, but I know it's in this same general area of food.
Yeah, fresh cheeses.
I have been making an Italian skillet cheesecake.
Right.
It's out of classic home desserts.
Uh-huh.
And the first time I made it with ricotta. The second time I made it with cottage cheese.
Right.
Then the third time I made it with ricotta again, because the cottage cheese did not taste as good.
That's right.
And I've made cottage cheese at home. What is the real difference between ricotta, cottage cheese, quark, and anything else in that?
Well, you know what it comes down to? It's Little Miss Muffet and her Tuffet and how you separate your curds and your whey.
Ah.
Now, there's a lot of ways of separating the solid and the liquid in milk.
Uh-huh.
And each way you do it produces a different cheese. You see? Uh-huh. That's the basic answer. Now,
uh-huh.
ricotta is usually done, traditionally done, with the whey or the liquid that is left from making cheese. And you add acid to that, and it could be, you know, lemon or vinegar or whatever, and you separate out more curd. These days, people make ricotta from whole milk, and I think it's all the better for it because it's a lush, lush, delicious thing.
Yeah.
Low fat or skim milk ricotta, I'm sorry, don't waste your money.
No.
But this is essentially, you add a bit of acid to the milk, some people even add a little cream, and you do a very slow, long heating on it, 20 minutes maybe, until you get these soft curds. They're like little pillows. You don't want to boil it. You don't want to get curds that are really hard. And that's when you drain it. And in fact, there's in my first book, The Splendid Table, is a recipe for homemade ricotta.
Ah.
Because it's so hard to get dynamite ricotta in supermarkets these days.
Uh-huh.
If the label says gelatin, if the label says anything else but milk, acid, maybe culture, or salt and salt, you do not want to buy it. Gelatin does not belong in ricotta.
Right.
Okay, so cottage cheese is made a couple of ways. One way is it's done with
buttermilk. And the buttermilk is added to the milk to help the separating of the curds and whey. But it's interesting because the milk is heated up to a particular temperature, like 100-something, 104. And then it's brought down to, then the buttermilk is added. It's brought down to about 72, 75 degrees. And it's held that way, like for 15 hours. And very gradually, the acid in the buttermilk and the culture in the buttermilk separates out the solid and the liquid. And then that's cooked. And that's one way of making it. Another way of making it is you add a rennet tablet, which is from the lining. Rennet is made from the lining of a young animal's stomach, usually veal, you know, a calf. And that will separate out the curds and the whey much more quickly.
Uh-huh.
But you get a completely different taste from cottage cheese. Right? You see, it's really interesting because it's all this business about how long and what does the separation. Quark is where you make a culture from yogurt or buttermilk, you add it to the milk, and you let that heat very gently for quite a while, and what happens is you get a separation, you get still it's like a milky sort of, it's not really solid curds,
right?
And you drain that in a cheesecloth. And you know what's similar to it? Quark is very popular in Germany. It's a soft cheese, tends to have a tang to it. What's similar is if you use whole milk yogurt, and you put it in a cheesecloth in a strainer and let it drain in a bowl overnight in the fridge, you'll get a yogurt cheese called Labneh, and it's very similar to Quark.
Right. I've done that.
So that's this thing. And probably what you had for the dessert in France may have been called fromage frais, and that is where milk is exposed to yet another culture, which will give it a different characteristic and taste.
Wow.
It's fascinating stuff. There's some websites with just about cheese making that you'll find fascinating.
Okay. Great.
This is what you can pull off, you know, at parties when there's nothing to talk about. You can just start explaining all this to people.
Right.
They will be fascinated. Hey, thank you for a great question.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Nice to talk to you.
You take care.
Okay.
You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Who's up next? Nora calling from Southampton, New York. Hey, Nora, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for answering my phone call.
You are welcome.
I'm calling because I have a nice variety of beautiful beans that I don't know what to do with. I planted a garden in the spring, and then I went away on a family vacation. I was gone for about a month. When I came home, the beans were, well, they were quite past their prime. So instead of picking them, I let them dry on the vine. And in the fall, with my family, we picked the beans, and we then shelled them. And they're very beautiful, but I wasn't sure what to do, whether I should rehydrate them, would they get mushy, or should I just plant them again next spring? It's a variety of green beans and cranberry beans, adzuki, the long Chinese beans, flat filet beans.
This sounds fabulous.
Any ideas?
Well, first of all, you probably have a mint right
I
there
do.
In the garden. Yeah,
yes.
Because these beans are now selling for ridiculous amounts of
money.
This, I think, is the thing. You now have dry beans.
Right.
Now, one of the things I would do is to make sure they're really dry is store them where there's air and light. In so many words, don't seal them up in a bag.
Okay.
You know, put them in open bowls or that kind of thing. And by the way, one of the things I love doing this with beans is I put them in flower vases. You know how, I don't know about you, but people send you flowers and you always end up with the glass vases and you don't know, you know, and you want to save them. But I have a little counter that I just have all my different beans in those things.
Right.
It allows the beans to breathe because if they're not fully dehydrated, you know, you don't want mold.
Right. I have them in a beautiful bowl that my brother actually made out of wood.
Oh, gorgeous. Now, have you mixed them all together?
I certainly did.
Well, they may cook at different rates, but you know what? That's not the end of the world.
Okay.
I think what you've got now is absolutely dynamite dried beans. And each one is going to have, from what you're saying, they're the green beans, which have almost a sweet overtone when they're dried. And they're, you know, they're classic with cassoulet.
Oh, right.
But they're also a classic with anything you want to put them with. And you said now you had cranberry beans, right?
Yep, I have several.
Okay. In Italy, by the way, those are called borlotti, and that's like the workhorse bean.
Right.
You know, anything. And again, they're meaty. They have a sweet undertone. What else have you got?
I have some of the long Chinese beans, the adzuki beans.
Oh, gosh, they're good. Yeah, yeah. They're really meaty. And they have almost a poultry undertone. I know it's weird. Well, any other, what other kind?
I have the flat, you know, the flat filet Italian beans. They're very similar to the green beans.
Right. Okay, I would leave them in the bowl. They're beautiful to look at. It's not going to do them any harm. The drier they get, the longer they'll take to cook.
Super.
But that's not a problem. I mean, beans can hold for a long time.
Right.
But right now, if you start cooking them now, I think you're going to be tasting them very close to their prime.
Okay.
So what I do is you can pre-soak them. You know, you can cover them with cold water. The long pre-soak is cold water in the fridge overnight.
Right.
The short pre-soak is pour boiling water over them, let them sit for an hour, pour off the water, and then cook them in water.
Okay.
Now, the thing when you cook beans, you can add garlic, you can add some onion, add salt toward the end. You're going to have to judge the cooking time because, again, these beans are younger than a lot of what you might find in the market.
Right.
And you've got different times. So if some of them seem overcooked by the time the others are done, don't worry about it. You still get all that flavor.
Okay, super.
And the thing, too, to remember with beans is if you add any form of acid to them, like vinegar or tomatoes or whatever, that keeps them from getting more tender.
Oh, really?
Now, you can play with this because you don't want to add those things when you're trying to actually cook the beans. But
right.
Let's say you then want to have them be in a tomato sauce.
Right.
Okay? Well, once the beans are cooked, the tomato sauce will keep them from overcooking any further.
Huh.
You see, so you can cook up the beans with water and some, you know, bay leaf and celery and carrot and onion if you want all those nice flavors. And then you can eat them as they are. You can use the broth, by the way, would make a fabulous broth for soup. The beans themselves, just cooked in the water with whatever flavorings you like, are going to make fabulous soup.
That sounds great.
Okay?
Super.
You have pure gold, girl.
Thank you very much.
Enjoy, Nora.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Call us, 800-537-5252. I should confess, by the way, I collect beans. I have carried beans from everywhere I've ever traveled to, and they're wonderful. Every bean is different. I mean, even the same bean grown in different places is different. Fascinating thing. Fairly harmless, too. Call us, guys, 800-537-5252. We have Ruth calling from Burnsville, North Carolina. Ruth, welcome. What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I love your fabulous program. I've been trying to get a hold of you for ages. My question is, I was just in England visiting my brother and, of course, made the obligatory visit to Fortnum & Mason's.
Right.
Actually, to get tea. And a lady was giving out free samples of rum-soaked, chocolate-covered raisins.
Ooh.
And they were incredible. And I've tried to make these. I'm a pretty good cook, been cooking for a long time. But they didn't turn out. The taste was good, but the chocolate wasn't as shiny, and it sort of crumbled a little bit.
All right. Now describe to me exactly what you're talking about. Was it little raisins that had been soaked in rum and then dunked in chocolate? Or
exactly right. Exactly right.
Okay.
That's what it was.
Okay. Then you know what it is?
Tell me.
Your chocolate has to be tempered. Now I don't remember the exact temperatures, but this is the deal.
Okay.
That it has to be heated, I think it's to something very gently, to 91 degrees. That somehow stays in my mind. But you can find this.
I can find that in a cookbook.
Well, yeah, and on websites as well. If you look
good.
For tempering chocolate.
Tempering chocolate,
yeah.
Okay.
And then what you do is it's heated, it's gently cooled, and then it's gently heated again. And it has to be kept at a particular temperature. I mean, this is what candy makers do to make that shiny, sort of crisp yet melting coating.
Exactly.
The other thing is that you want to use a really fine quality chocolate and one that only has cocoa mass and cocoa butter in it, and maybe a little lecithin. It will have sugar and some vanilla flavoring. But read the label. You don't want anything else in there.
Now, do you have a recommendation for what kind of chocolate to get?
If you want to float a bank loan, one of my favorites is Valrhona. But Calibo is a bit better priced, and it really has good quality.
Okay.
Another one that's really, I think, high quality for the money is Lindt, L-I-N-D-T.
Oh, I know Lindt, of course, That I can get pretty easily.
Yeah.
And do I get the dark kind, right, the dark?
Well, if that's what you want, yes, you do. And the dark kind has a lot of cocoa in it and a fair amount of cocoa butter and not much sugar.
That's what we want.
But go on the web and just search for the technique for tempering chocolate. It's a little exacting, but when you nail it, it's going to be really easy, and you're going to get gorgeous, professional-looking
raisins. That's what I want.
Raisins.
You can't believe how delicious these were.
Oh, I can imagine. And do you use big raisins for it, too?
Well, no, I didn't do that, but I guess that's a great idea.
Well, I'm just thinking more is better than less. It comes down to basic
concept. You're the best. You're the best.
Hey, thank you so much. You made my day, Ruth.
Well, thank you.
You
Bye-bye.
Take care. Goodbye.
Bye.
Rum-soaked raisins. I'll bet you could do that with apricots, and they're big. Wouldn't it be great if you could finish dinner and just toss away the china plates? No more washing dishes. Well, the MIT Media Lab's Counterintelligence Group is rethinking the dinner dish. The Counterintelligence Group is a gang of academics who rethink how we function with food. They've conjured a scentophone, which transmits the scents of what you're cooking, countertops that display the recipe that you're making, and picture-taking refrigerators, not of you, but of their contents. Now Counterintelligence is taking on cleanup with this machine. It's called Dishmaker, and it's the brainchild of grad student Leonardo Bonanni. I have Leonardo on the phone. Leonardo, welcome.
Hi, Lynn. Thank you.
So tell me about the invention. Is it sort of a big contraption?
Well, it's still a prototype, but the idea is to really replace or rethink the role of dishes altogether in the kitchen. And the idea came from a desire to just throw them away when you're done eating and just get new ones next time you're ready to eat and not have to worry about storing them or washing them.
A mass desire, I should say, considering how most of us feel about washing dishes. So how does it actually work?
Well, it's a pretty innovative machine. It basically just takes a special kind of plastic and it stamps it into different kinds of shapes. We tried to give it a nice, thick, heavy feeling like ceramic, but it'll make cups, it'll make plates and bowls, and it takes about a minute to spit each one out right now. So in 15 minutes or so, you have all the settings you need for a typical dinner. And then when you're done, you just throw them back in this machine. It's about the size of a dishwasher. And again, in about 15 minutes, all the material is recycled back to its original shape, and then it can be used again, but it can be used in any shape. So you can have soup bowls made one day. You can have just cups for cocktails one day. You can have plates the next day. So we reuse the same material.
Now, I gather it's sterilized in the process, so you don't have the problem of residual food and that kind of thing.
It is sterilized, although we're still working on things like a waterless dishwasher built in so that we can get rid of everything. Right now, you still have to wipe them down.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Well,
it's a shame if
I don't have to wash them. But can you do this sort of ad infinitum? Because I'm thinking of plastic, landfill, you know, all of those problems.
Right. And that's one of the most interesting parts of the project for me. I found these materials that have a memory, and so they can pretty much indefinitely be formed into one thing and then another and then another and then another. And what that does, it doesn't just save the plastic from having to go to a landfill. It also saves a lot of room. I mean, conceivably, a lot of your cabinets wouldn't have to exist, and your dishwasher, too.
So, and that you said, how big is the machine again?
Right now, I made the machine to be about as big as a normal dishwasher. So I've suggested that it will replace completely what we think of as a dishwasher.
What
right
does
now.
It look like? Can I get different patterns? What do the dishes actually look like?
The dishes look a little odd, but they they basically all look similar, but they have different depths, and we're working with different colors and also patterns, so you can stamp people's names around the table or decorations so you can get more variety.
This is a great idea, Leonardo. Hey, thank you for talking to us.
It's a pleasure, Lynn. Thank you.
Leonardo Bonanni is a graduate student working at MIT's Media Labs in the Counterintelligence Group. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this quote. It comes from Jack Staub's gardening book, and it's supposedly from an unnamed French poet. He or she said, "There are three things which cannot support mediocrity: poetry, wine, and melons." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Now, everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek. Register for it online, splendidtable.org. Additional support for our program comes from gather.com, where you can read recipes and helpful hints from the Splendid Table. You can share your perspective at gather.com, online at gather.com. Our producers are Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell, with help from Janelle Sorensen. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham, Julia Schrankler, and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.